This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Some thoughts this hour on the new births this hour. Democracy in Ukraine coming into being. A new culture of banking on Wall Street. Some heroes being born at the Sochi Olympics. And the way in which mortgages work these days, that's a new phenomenon that was born when you might not have been paying attention. All of that this hour, but we begin with a city and a nation dominating the headlines. That's the famous theme from The Great Gates of Kiev, from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition Orchestral Suite. Central Kiev is shrouded in a haze of smoke today. And the songs depicting the people of Kiev and Ukraine are not being written by Russian composers. It is homegrown Ukrainian voices like pop singer Ruslana.
You make me angry. You drive me crazy.
On the barricades herself earlier this week, Ruslana declared to crowds of protesters, Europe, stop promising, start acting. Europe in Ukraine is being killed before your eyes. Democratic Ukraine and people who choose European values are being destroyed before your eyes. Authorities, she shouted, come to your senses. Europe and the world, notice us. Notice Ukraine in the center of Europe. Well, President Obama claimed this week that the U.S. is paying attention to what's going on in Kiev.
We'll be monitoring very carefully the situation, recognizing that along with our European partners and the international community, there will be consequences if people step over the line.
But amidst the worst violence of the last few weeks, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych fired the head of the armed forces and announced something of a truce yesterday. The current unrest and drama in Kiev is hardly the first time this city has been at the center of turmoil in Europe. Marta Dichok is a professor of history and international politics at the University of Western Ontario and author of The Grand Alliance and Ukrainian Refugees. She joins us from Toronto. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So looking at what's going on in Kiev right now, it reminds me of the historical treasures that were overrun and destroyed in Bosnia, in Damascus, certainly within the last 2 years. What are your feelings watching what's unfolding in Kiev?
As I saw the smoke rising and the fires burning in Kyiv Central Square, I thought, am I watching World War II or is this reality live streamed from Kyiv via the internet? It's the first time that there's been this sort of violence since World War II, and shocking is just the word that comes to mind. It seems so inadequate.
I can hear just the emotional sort of tension in your voice. Describe for us the extent to which Kiev has been really at the center of change in Europe going back hundreds of years.
Kyiv is an ancient, ancient capital that was the center of civilization in the 9th century before Moscow was even a city. The children of the princes of Kyiv were married to France, to other European capitals. It's been at the center of power struggles throughout its history. The Mongols invaded it in 1240. Throughout history, people have been trying to take over the city, conquer it. In the First World War, when Ukraine tried to declare independence, the Bolsheviks came and took over. The Second World War, again, the German and the Soviet armies were battling over Kyiv, bombing it. It's so distressing to see that it's happening from the inside now.
And Russian literary figures, poets and novelists describe Kiev with such fondness and affection, yet that affection seems to be lost in the turmoil that's going on today. Do you think that the love between Ukraine and Russia is gone now, is something completely of the past?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I think Ukrainians and Russians and Poles and Lithuanians and Georgians, they all live together. They're neighbors. There's a lot of intermarriage. The issue here is what's happening and what sort of future Ukraine is choosing for itself. And there are a lot of Ukrainians in Kyiv throughout the country that have been saying, we are European. We want to live in a normal country. And unfortunately, there are others who are behaving in a way that's barbaric. And that's what the violence is all about. It's a clash of values.
In many ways, you come directly out of this history. If you were there, if you were in Kiev with as much at stake as the protesters or as citizens who haven't taken a political position, what would you say? You want to be more European or you want to be more Russian?
Well, I think all the people that have been out on the streets for months have been saying we are European. It's not we want to be European, we are European. Geographically, historically, culturally, it's just the politics now is in question. And when we say European, let's not forget that Europe today is a democracy, but if we look at the history of Europe, there's all sorts of other ideologies, fascism, Nazism, these sort of ideological clashes are European.
So, Professor, you know, the pop singer Ruslana was talking at the barricades earlier this week. Europe and the world notice us. Notice Ukraine in the center of Europe. Now, it sounds like she might have misspoke in that she's calling for the people in the center of Europe, say Berlin and Paris, to notice. But for a lot of Ukrainians, Kiev is the center of Europe. Is that true for you?
Well, I would say Kyiv is European. Where the center lies, I think, is not really the point. The point is that Ukrainians who are trying to oppose oppression are appealing to other Europeans and say, help us. There is this video that's just gone viral of a young woman standing in the square saying, you know, please help us.
How are you following things? I can tell that you're very much there on the streets, even though you're, you know, an academic at the University of Western Ontario, and there's a long tradition of Ukrainians in Canada really following very closely the situation in Ukraine. How are you following it?
Well, the wonders of modern technology means that we now can live stream television globally. So I've been watching pretty much day and night what's been happening in the last few months. A number of online TV stations have appeared. Wonderful timing, because now anybody who wants to can watch. And what horrifies me is the perpetrators of violence don't seem to care that they're killing people in front of the world's eyes. This isn't happening somewhere far away. Anybody can watch this. That just is mind-boggling to me, how you can be shooting live ammunition and knowing that the whole world is watching and this is all being recorded, and someday you will be held accountable.
And in a sense, the Ukraine unrest may be a moment where there is less of a concern than there has been in the past that these pictures will call people to be held accountable. You say people are doing this clearly in the light of the Internet day in our 21st century.
But they will be held accountable. That's just it. It's all being recorded. All of the faces, all of the actions. I mean, when this stops, and hopefully it'll stop soon, the peace will come, and let's not forget the Nuremberg trials. I mean, people will eventually be held accountable.
What do you think the end game is here? Do you think peace will come soon? And if so, will Viktor Yanukovych, the president, be responsible for bringing this to an end?
Peace will come. The only question is how quickly and at what cost. I think the president is in an extremely weak position, and he seems to be unable to stop the violence, and that's quite worrying. The fact that he's changing ministers, and yet this is continuing, is quite worrying.
Do the armed forces have an independent constituency here? Do they have the ability to rally the people, as was the case in some other European countries, and if not take power, at least to create a transition?
There's no precedent of military taking over in Ukraine or that part of the world, for that matter. The army has enjoyed high levels of public trust throughout the years of Ukraine's independence. But the question is, who will be the leader? The army is simply an instrument. It's who's giving the orders. And that's the question.
In the violence and the fact that so much of the Ukrainian economy has been affected by the events of the last 2 months, is the opposition, the traditional political opposition, discredited in any sense, or are they likely to emerge stronger from all of this, in your view?
The Ukrainian economy has been under pressure for a while, in some part because Russia has been exercising economic sanctions against Ukraine as it was moving towards the European Union. So the economic problems are longstanding and not caused by this crisis. The crisis has simply intensified them. The opposition is divided, and the protests were started by activists and ordinary people and not the political opposition. And part of the problem is that the only way out of the crisis is through negotiated solution. and the opposition leaders, although they're trying, they don't seem to be able to come together and speak with a single voice. Mm. So they have some popular support, but certainly not enough.
Finally, before we go, some have said in the media that Ukraine controls the floodgates of Russian gas going to natural gas going to Western Europe. Would Ukraine play that card? And is that a myth, or would Ukraine actually play that card?
Well, Ukraine, the pipeline that takes Russian natural gas to Europe goes through Ukraine, and that creates a situation of interdependency because Ukraine buys gas from Russia, but for Russia to sell its gas, it goes through Ukraine. So they're interdependent. And when Russia turned off the gas in Ukraine in 2005 after Viktor Yushchenko came to power in the wake of the Orange Revolution, Russia did actually turn off the gas. And then Ukraine simply said, okay, well, if you turn off our gas, we're going to turn off the gas to Western Europe. And the standoff ended very quickly.
But high stakes here in this
extremely
conflict.
High.
Marta Tichok, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marta Tichok is a professor of history and international politics at the University of Western Ontario, author of The Grand Alliance and Ukrainian Refugees. Focusing back in the U.S., here's a question. When you start your adult life about $50,000 in debt, what can't you do in the way of spending? Multiply that by a few million college graduates over the past few years, and you can do the math. The debt may just constitute a brake on the U.S. economy for people who might otherwise be inclined to spend as they strike out on their own. One of you in Texas has done the math.
Hi, this is Jennifer. I'm calling from Glen Rose, Texas. My husband and I are drowning in student loan debt. 3 bachelor's degrees, 3 master's degrees, and 10 years later, we still owe over $45,000. This has inspired us to save every spare penny that we can so that our 3 children never live under this cloud of debt.
Saving is great, but again, what stimulus might they have put into the economy there in Texas without all that debt? Down the road in San Marcos, Texas, paying back loans takes about 40% of my income each month. I'm past the point of deferment for many. I'll probably be in debt until I die, just like 95% of Americans. I have to keep all expenses to the bare minimum and can't afford to have much fun or even savings money.
Hi, my name is Megan Morales. I'm calling from Seattle. I graduated a few years ago with several thousands of dollars in student loan debt, and because of that, my partner and I made a decision to buy our home in his name so it didn't affect my credit when I go to apply for loans.
Clever. How about this from Smithfield, Utah? I won't get married until I pay off my student debt. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Let us know about your student debt and how it has affected your lifestyle at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Is the ethos of the new Wall Street banker changing? That's one question post-recession for the U.S. economy. But here's another. Right now, we can see how structurally the mortgage business barely resembles what it once was. Banks originating mortgages, managing the payments, nudging people to stay current and keeping track of who's on time, who's late, and who's about to be evicted. That was largely the system before the crash in 2008. Banks still originate mortgages, but in the wake of the mortgage securities debacle, where mortgages are bundled and sold anywhere in the world as investment instruments, it is the servicing of all those mortgages that increasingly underpins the value of financial assets. This steeply rising trend of banks handing off loans to servicers means that consumers may have entered into a new world. Joining us now to explain that world is Jessica Silver Greenberg, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
So these servicers are big companies. They're not little paper shufflers, right?
No, servicers they're getting increasingly large. What happened is the banks prior to the financial crisis and also after the financial crisis, they did their own servicing for the most part, which meant that what a servicer does, it's kind of a technical term, but they collect payments from borrowers, principal and interest, and then they pass those on to lenders and the investors that hold these mortgages, as you said, bundled and sliced, and they hold those in securities. So what's happening now is banks are increasingly unwilling and uninterested in doing that servicing business. There are a number of reasons why they're not interested in it, but the impact, or rather the cumulative effect, is that they are transferring these servicing rights to companies that most consumers have probably never heard of. And they are, and these companies, this new brand of mortgage servicer, they're getting bigger and at a very rapid clip.
And they're under a lot of pressure here. It's companies like Ocwen Financial, NationStar, Walter Investments. Those are some of the companies that you mention in some of your reporting. These companies are under pressure to make sure that these securities hold their value. And so the consumer really is a little bit down in the food chain here. How have you found that that has actually had an impact on consumers and their payments and their interactions with these servicers?
Well, I think there are two dynamics going on. I mean, the first is that we're seeing just the sheer volume of mortgage servicing rights, that's the technical term for them, change hands, that in that transition there are kinks and problems that are emerging just because there are mix-ups that happen. There are delays. There are lost documents. And the new servicers are buying this stuff up so quickly that some state and federal regulators worry that they simply don't have the capacity yet, the infrastructure capacity, the customer service capacity. And so what is happening is consumers are increasingly encountering many of the same frustrations that we saw them encounter with the big bank servicers, and the same problems, including this kind of shoddy paperwork, the bungled modifications, the potentially, you know, erroneous fees, and ultimately wrongful evictions that we saw with the big banks, and that resulted in a recent, in 2012, $26 billion settlement with federal authorities. So that's some of what's happening.
We're talking with Jessica Silver Greenberg, who's a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. So, you know, the irony here is that there is a real need for these servicers to perform their job well. Otherwise, you know, we're headed for another crash. The lack of servicing was part of the reason why the real estate market collapsed, because nobody could tell the value of any of these sorts of things. Yet the capacity for doing this, I'm wondering if that can ever be as good as what it needs to be. Are these servicers regulated in the same way that banks are, or is it a gray area?
They are regulated, but not in the same way that banks are. What you're seeing is a shift from the hyperly regulated or the regulated banks to the servicers. Now, these new servicers, they're regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Officials there have said that they are very closely scrutinizing the transfer of these mortgage servicing rights to ensure that homeowners don't fall through the cracks. So, again, these firms are regulated. They don't have the same regulatory requirements that banks do. So, for example, banks have to hold a certain amount of capital to cushion against any losses that might come from those mortgage servicing rights. That's a requirement that was enacted after the financial crisis. The new mortgage servicers don't have those capital requirements. They are regulated, but again, we're talking about a different regulatory structure than those that banks are confronting.
And the incentive structure has changed. I mean, if a bank forecloses, they're basically assuming the responsibility of a property. They're taking a loss. There is an incentive built in there for the bank to maybe hold on to this relationship with this consumer. A servicer, it's almost an administrative detail, whether someone is foreclosed upon or whether their mortgage is changed in some way to allow them to continue paying.
I don't think that's entirely fair. I mean, I think the banks before, when they were servicing these mortgages, and they still do service mortgages, but, you know, when they were servicing these mortgages, they also were collecting payments on behalf of lenders and investors. They had those same obligations. What is different, it's a little more subtle in that banks have a different relationship with their customers. If they're servicing your mortgage, they may also have a concurrent relationship with you. You might do banking with them. You might have a checking account with them. You might have a savings account, 401k. There are many different relationships that the banks have with their borrowers whose mortgages they're servicing. They also have, more broadly, reputational concerns. They have retail brands, and so there's more pressure on them to ensure that customer service experience goes smoothly.
Jessica Silver Greenberg is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, talking about the growth of the mortgage servicing business in the banking sector. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Thank you.
So if you are already significantly in debt, and Americans who took out loans to go to college hold about $1 trillion in student loan debt right about now, why would you ever want to take out a home mortgage?
This is Courtney Rohde from Seattle, Washington. My husband and I both got our bachelor's degree 3 years ago and graduated with a combined $50,000 of student loan debt. Since then, we've prioritizing trying to pay off our loans, especially the ones with 6% interest rate, over investing in the market or our 401ks. We still have about $35,000 to pay off, which has pushed off either of us pursuing a master's or an MBA, and we also won't be saving for a while for a down payment on a house until we can pay off more of our loans.
Ouch. The Mortgage Bankers Association says loan applications for home purchases have slipped nearly 20% in the past 4 months compared with the same period a year ago. And David Stevens, chief executive of the Mortgage Bankers Association, joins us. David, welcome.
Hi, John.
We've been asking this question. Does all this student debt constitute a brake on the economy and the home mortgage industry? Are you noticing this 20% slippage might be due to student loan debt and decisions made on the basis of it?
Yeah, it's hard to draw the exact correlation, but let me just put it to you this way. First-time home buyers are run typically at about 40% of total purchases. In the last 2 years, they've actually averaged below 30%. So we're seeing a clear lack of activity in first-time home buyers entering the marketplace. And the one variable we look at is the debt structure. Aggregate debt levels in this country are actually dropping. There's been a slight uptick in auto loans reflecting the strength of the industry. But otherwise, they've been dropping except for student loan debt, which has grown from about $250 billion in 2003 to near $1 trillion now in total debt. That adds an enormous weight on young people exiting college who may be wanting to, at some point in the near term, once they get established in a job, to be able to buy a home. And we see it in the actual debt levels of college graduates versus other households.
And the irony, and I speak to you now as a former FHA commissioner for the Obama administration, which you were, you know, during a time of recession, people going back to school and taking out loans to go back to school constitutes a kind of stimulus in the sense that people are trying to upgrade their employability to be able to get back into the workforce. But the debt is a kind of counter-cyclical break on the economy. So what you gain in stimulus sending people back to school, you lose in their buying power when they get out.
That's absolutely right. And you can take this and multiply the effect in many different ways. It affects the move-up home purchase market. So it has a broader impact on the housing market, which is, you know, roughly 40 basis points of the GDP. If first-time home buyers don't enter, the people who own those homes can't move on to the next home. Likewise, in the rental community, as you well know, in places like New York City and other urban markets where young people tend to find their first jobs in higher percentages in any case, it creates rent inflation, and that disrupts families who are likely longer-term renters who may actually be forced out of their homes and have to move out to more remote locations because the supply and demand effect on the rental housing. So the imbalance affects families, and it affects the economy. And it's
I'm sketching here on the back of a napkin. We just got about a minute. Seems to me that if the federal government forgave about a quarter of $1 trillion in student loans, that might be the best stimulus for the Mortgage Bankers Association.
Well, look, the two things we know. One, we don't want to put people into unsustainable environments and talking them into buying a home when they're not ready. So the borrowers have to be ready. But when they are, this has a hangover effect. I think it's an extraordinary challenge for policymakers. You've heard some members of Congress raise this as a significant issue. I think the noise around this subject needs to get louder.
David Stevens, chief executive of the Mortgage Bankers Association and former FHA commissioner for the Obama administration. Thanks, David.
Thanks, John.
Olympically speaking, hockey is just the best for both women and men at the Olympics. Unless you're Russian, they're out of the contest. The men's team is. But remaining are the U.S. powerhouses, Canada, Sweden, and Finland. Ben McGrath has been covering Olympic hockey for The New Yorker. He's a writer at The New Yorker. Ben, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
So I know that you're a bit of a hockey maniac. Let's just talk a little bit about the strength of the Canadians, the strength of the Swedes and the Finns, and whether the U.S. have a chance.
The U.S. definitely has a chance. In fact, they've probably played the best hockey of any of the teams so far, which is a bit of a surprise. The two semifinal matches, if you think about it, are they're rematches of the last two gold medal games from the previous two Olympics. So the U.S. against Canada, which we have tomorrow, was the final in Vancouver in 2010. That went to overtime. And then Sweden and Finland, that was the final in Turin. So in some senses, it hasn't really been that surprising, except for the Russian failure.
The Russian failure is kind of interesting in the sense that the strategy that the Russians used for piling up their teams with NHL stars versus what the U.S. did, and that was work more on a kind of an ensemble approach, really failed for the Russians.
Yeah, the Russians were a very top-heavy, kind of superstar-centric team. They had some of the most dynamic players in the world. But you sometimes had the sense while watching them that they were all watching one another play. They kind of reminded me of the old joke against the Red Sox in the 70s, which is that the locker room is 25 taxi cabs and not a team bus.
That's interesting. Are any of these teams here, and you know, when we think of Canada versus the U.S. in hockey, that's what happens in the NHL, you know, every year. But if we're talking about Sweden and Finland, are these homegrown local teams in any more significant way than the U.S. and Canadian teams?
Not especially. Both the Sweden and Finland teams are largely NHL driven. I think the Finns probably have 8 or 9 players, maybe from the Russian Continental Hockey League. I mean, these are Finnish guys, but they play professionally in Russia. One of the things that hockey people often talk about in these tournaments is the size of the rink. In the Olympic tournament, usually in Europe especially, they play on a wider international size rink, which is 100 feet wide, versus in the NHL, it's 85 feet wide. And the Swedes and the Finns have grown up playing in a wider rink and sometimes are thought to be better adapted to it.
What about those Slovakians?
Well, the Slovakians are out, so they certainly surprised the Russians. The Russians could not score in a whole regulation game against the Slovakians,
which was astounding. Finally, before we go, you know, one of the great things about the Olympics and hockey and how television really sort of dominates it, while sometimes television gets in the way, I think with the big screens and the HD, hockey is just perfect for TV. And my hockey fans just go absolutely crazy this time of year.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about hockey, the knock against it always used to be that you couldn't watch it on TV because you couldn't see the puck. And now with HD TV, not only can you see the puck, but you can really appreciate the gaps in between the teeth of the guys, and you can see sort of, you know, the ice chips flying into the goalie's face. It's pretty impressive.
And all of the fast action puts you right out over the ice, whereas even with the delays in the NFL football and in baseball, the HD doesn't necessarily help you so much. It's a really great seat to have that big screen and the HD, particularly in hockey, because it moves so fast.
Yeah, I know. I think hockey has certainly gained the most of all the sports from HD TV. I mean, it remains a great live experience. To me, being live at a hockey rink is sort of the supreme sporting fan experience. But HD TV is pretty close to getting you there.
You want to call the medals for the men in Olympic hockey for this weekend?
Yeah, I think the U.S. will win. Tomorrow is going to be real tough, but I'm going to guess that the U.S. beats Finland.
And so the U.S. will get the gold. Finland will get the silver, and the Canadians will get the bronze.
That's my, yeah, sure.
Interesting. We'll try to hold that hold you to that. Yeah, Ben McGrath, New Yorker staff writer and a rink rat blogger for the sporting scene on the New Yorker. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Millions of Americans saw this moment of an NBC reporter going for the emotional heroics with Olympic downhill skier Bodie Miller.
I know you wanted to be here with Chile, really experiencing these games. And how much does it mean to you to come up with a great performance for him? And was it for him?
I mean, I don't know if it's really for him, but I wanted to come here and I don't know, I guess make myself proud, but...
Olympics coverage creates this very emotional Hollywood narrative around every athlete, some who have faced significant adversity beyond the conditioning for the games, like the tragedies in Bodie Miller's life, but also some whose creds seem pumped up. the champion curler who overcame psoriasis, that sort of thing. But what are legitimate Olympic heroics on and off the ice and snow? You might include this year Pakistani skier Mohammed Karim, who had to deal with the Taliban destroying the ski facility where he trained back in 2008. It was never rebuilt. He competed on Wednesday, finished next to last. Last place was the Indian skier, and the Pakistani headline was Pakistan Beats India. David Walachinsky is president of the International Society of Olympic Historians, has seen more than a few Olympic heroics in his years of watching the Games. He joins me now from Sochi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Lots of little gems being created this Olympics, but take us back to the real heroics that stand out for you down through Olympic history.
I believe that, you know, a hero isn't just winning gold medals, though it doesn't hurt. One of my favorite stories is from the Atlanta Games, where there was a man from Burundi named Dudonne Kwizera. And he was a great runner in the late 80s and early 90s, but Burundi didn't have an Olympic committee. So he took his prize money from running around the world, and he created a Burundi Olympic committee. By the time it was recognized by the International Olympic Committee, he was no longer a top-ranked runner. So he went to the Atlanta Olympics as a coach. Then one of the leading Burundi runners, Venuste Niyongabo, who was going to run in the 1,500 meters, he came to Kwizera and he said, "You know what, I think I'll just run in the 5,000, and why don't you take my place in the 1,500? And so Kwizera did get to compete in the Olympics after all, kissed the track at the end of the race. Meanwhile, Niyongabo entered the 5,000, a race he had only competed in twice, and he won the gold medal.
Here's that moment.
And I would say this is a gold medal run. Less than 200 to go. It's now about silver and bronze. Bitoker got the silver 4 years ago. Bellamy is there. Bowman, the gold medalist of 4 years ago. But Noyan Garbi of Burundi is going to take their first ever gold medal in the Olympic Games.
So, David, as an Olympic historian, you've got to know the story of Watho Huck, Jim Thorpe, right? Tell that story.
He was an orphan. Part Indian, very much part Indian. And then one day he was walking along at the Carlisle School and he noticed some athletes trying to do the high jump. They had set it at a school record. I think it was 5'9". And so Thorpe, who was just walking along in his work clothes, walked over and cleared the high jump, thus setting a school record. He went on to become probably the greatest athlete of the 20th century. He won the gold medal in the 1912 decathlon and the pentathlon, but had his medals taken away because he had played semi-professional baseball. Being naive, he had used his own name, unlike all the other Americans who just simply changed their name.
Do you think that Nadia Comăneci, the Romanian in the Montreal Olympics, was a hero or just a standout athlete?
She was a standout athlete. To me, you're not a hero just because you're a great athlete. You're a hero when you take those qualities that made you a great athlete, that concentration, that striving for perfection, and you then apply it to something else in your life. To me, a hero is the Norwegian speed skater Johan Olaf Koss, who won gold medals. Yes, he did. But then he took that, you know, that same striving for doing the best he could, and he devoted himself to, you know, helping children around the world, bringing soccer balls, bringing athletic facilities around the world. That, to me, is a hero.
So let's hear the moment of Johan Olaf Koss.
The gold medal and third Olympic title in the space of 7 days to Johan Olaf Koss of Norway. Becomes the first winter sportsman in Olympic history to win 3 gold medals in the same Olympic Games, all in new world record times.
That is completely amazing. But I also think similarly amazing is Noriaki Kasai, who is in his 7th Olympics, I believe, and finally won his first individual medal. What about persistence?
Well, that's a fantastic story. Both Noriaki Kasai of Japan, the ski jumper, and Albert Demchenko of Russia became the first athletes in the history of the Winter Olympics to compete in 7 different Winter Olympics. Kasai had won a team medal 20 years ago, and now at the age of 41 at the Sochi Olympics, he won a silver medal, an individual silver medal. And yes, as you say, that is persistence, and also it's an incredible story of staying at the top of your game for so long.
Do the heroics in the Olympics fade in our time compared with what you've studied in the past? And the Olympic movement now is, you know, well over a century old.
Yes, there's always somebody. I mean, I'd like to, you know, give some credit to particularly one American back in 2000 in the Sydney Games, not that long ago, really. And this was a taekwondo athlete named Esther Kim. And Esther Kim was best friends with her so-called rival, Kay Po, who was actually somewhat better than she was. And Esther Kim's father was both of their coach. And Kay Po was injured. And so when it came time for the U.S. finals, the trials, to see which of the two of them was going to go to the Sydney Olympics, Po was not in 100%, so Kim knew she'd beat her easily, so instead she forfeited. She gave up her chance to go to the Olympics so that her best friends, Kay Po, would qualify, and it was Kay Po who represented the United States in the flyweight class at the Sydney Olympics in taekwondo.
I remember that story. It was amazing. Did those things get lost in the coverage today?
I try to keep them up. We tend to follow who's going to win the medals, who's this, that, so forth. So I just try to keep track of these good people because they deserve to be put down in history.
David Wolaczynski is president of the International Society of Olympic Historians, speaking to us from Sochi, Russia. Have a great Games, David.
Thank you.
Oh, we can be heroes just for one day.
You be the judge now. Is this a joke or is this whole scene a joke?
Ted, what's the biggest difference between Hillary Clinton and a catfish?
Hillary Clinton and a catfish. I think one's feared in the water and one's feared on land.
Oh, Ted, no way. Nope, 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 no. One has whiskers and stinks, and the other is a fish.
That's two private equity giants joking at a secret Wall Street Society meeting in 2012, Kappa Beta Phi, crashed by a then New York Times reporter who watched as Wall Street's biggest names dressed up in drag, made tasteless jokes, and celebrated greed and excess. This elaborate scene is recounted in a piece in New York Magazine where Kevin Roos, that New York Times reporter, now works. But it is a minor scene in his book about what may be a much bigger idea than chronicling misbehaving billionaires. Kevin Roos's Young Money is all about the newbies on Wall Street and how the passing of the torch in the financial business right now may leave some odd traditions behind. And that may be a good thing. Kevin Roos, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start right out with this. Am I listening to the sound of a dying culture or a culture that's just being born? Listen to this moment that you know actually quite well.
I worked on Wall Street. And Wall Street just released.
So set the scene there. A bunch of older guys are screaming, "You suck," and a bunch of younger folks dressed up like Mormons are singing from the Book of Mormon, all about a prophecy that they're going to be rich.
Right. Well, it's a song, I believe, from the Book of Mormon, except they changed the words to say things like, I believe that God has a plan for all of us. I believe that my plan involves a seven-figure bonus.
And what did you make of that? I mean, in a sense, this is a secret meeting that you found your way into. It would have been shocking if they were discussing actually whether Peruvians get the right price for their commodities and whether people in Bangladesh are actually fairly compensated. That would have been a shocker.
Right. I mean, in some ways, this was a parody of sort of the ways that we as normal people imagine that the ultra-wealthy act behind closed doors, the secret society called Kappa Beta Phi, 80 years old. And for me, the shock was that this was all going on in January of 2012, sort of only 2 or 3 months after Occupy Wall Street was sort of at its peak. So these are people who had been keeping a low profile for good reason. And then when they were behind closed doors, they thought amongst themselves, they let loose with all manner of, degrading, homophobic, sexist jokes about the 99,
about Barney Frank,
yeah. The 99%, singing songs called Bailout King to the tune of ABBA's Dancing Queen. I mean, they really let loose, and I was sitting there in a rented tuxedo sort of taking this all in.
But the mission of your book, to try to figure out if the culture that is emerging in Wall Street is different from what you saw
And I guess the question is, they both were together at that sort of induction ceremony. What did you make of the sort of passing of the torch that might have been going on?
So the young bankers that I followed for Young Money, the eight first and second year analysts at firms like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, they were not at the Kappa Beta Phi meeting. They are still very much too young and inexperienced to be invited to something like that. But I spent 3 years following these guys around and learning about their lives after the crash. And what I found is that in some ways their lives are the polar opposite of sort of the over-the-top Wolf of Wall Street type atmosphere. They work incredibly long hours, sometimes 100, 110 hours a week. There's a thing called the banker 9-to-5 where they work from 9 a.m. until 5 a.m. the next day. And to the extent that they're taking drugs like they do in the movies, it's so that they can stay up later and work more. So I think it's a bifurcated culture, and there's a generation gap in finance, and that's what I wanted to explore was not only how are the CEOs acting, but how are the people who are just starting out acting?
And so in many ways, this secret society business was a depiction of the generation gap, not necessarily the core ethos of what's going on. The people you profiled are bankers who want to make money.
They're bankers who want to make money, but they're also – they come to Wall Street for all kinds of reasons. And this was a shock to me when I started interviewing these young bankers. Some of them told me that they had come for the money. But some of them also told me that money had had very little to do with it, that they were just in college. They wanted to have a job. They, you know, they went to a school that sends a phenomenally high proportion of its graduates to Wall Street, and it was what all their friends were doing. So I think there's a sort of – there was at least a social pressure and an anxiety that sort of leads people to Wall Street if they don't know what else to do with their lives.
So do you think the people that you profiled will end up like this? Listen.
Well, I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old farms there are not forgotten. Look away.
Look away.
Look away.
Look away.
Look away, Wall Street.
Look away from Wall Street.
Now, to the tune of Dixie, that's a story of the financial crash at the secret society meeting that you crashed. Warren Stevens is one of the folks singing there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the young folks that you profiled will end up like that?
I don't think so, and maybe that's hopelessly naive of me, but I actually think this generation of young bankers is much more socially attuned to the realities of the world they live in. What shocked me as I was interviewing these people is how much dissent and doubt there was among the people in the ranks. And when I told the young bankers about this Kappa Beta Phi dinner and all the offensive things I'd seen there, they'd never heard of this organization. And to them, one of them said it sounded like something that Occupy Wall Street would have invented if they wanted people to hate bankers even more.
So in some ways, the ultra wealthy, the focus of, you know, the financial channels are really on the fringe in terms of the culture that you explored.
I think they are, and I think they set the tone, obviously. But there are relatively few of those people compared to the people who are young and in the trenches and working these 100-hour weeks. And those are the people who are going to be leading Wall Street 20 years from now.
A nasty scene you managed to capture, but a pretty hopeful message from your book.
I hope so. I think if that's the litmus test. If in 20 years Kappa Beta Phi is still around, maybe Wall Street hasn't changed that much after all. But I think it has.
One last point. The guy who outed you, Michael Novogratz, a billionaire, is a college wrestler. He could have broken you in half, you know.
He really could have. And I'm glad I didn't escape out of that party on a stretcher.
Kevin Roos is a staff writer for New York Magazine and author of Young Money. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Perhaps people on Wall Street can pay back their student debt faster than the experience of one of you in St. Ignace, Michigan. I had about $40,000 in debt, and I'm still trying to pay it off. Upon graduation, I was not able to find a job in my field and have languished ever since. Whether bad luck or poor decision-making, I'm too far removed from my field to enter it now. I've come to the conclusion that college has been a huge mistake for me, and I have no interest in going back to school to take on more debt. Right. No incentive there for more punishment. And here's another voice from Michigan, Cadillac. I had a very small loan. It has not harmed me much, but I'm still phobic of debt. Education in this nation costs far too much. A man should be able to work and go to school without incurring massive debt. debt forgiveness. Maybe the federal government should bail out hardworking students. That would be heroic. Tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway with your student debt story. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything else on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.